If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's interview is with the historian, author and broadcaster Lawrence Rees, who's made several documentary series for BBC television, with a particular focus on the Second World War. Lawrence's latest book is Hitler and Stalin, which examines the actions of the Soviet and Nazi leaders during the course of the Second World War. He spoke to BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
So, Lawrence, many books have been written about both Hitler and Stalin, but what do you see as the benefits of the comparative approach you take in your book?
Well, really, I have to say how I came up with the idea and wanted to do it. And this came from making a series of documentaries over a number of years about the Nazi state and then also about Stalin and the Soviet Union. And what I began to find, having had the opportunity to meet people who either worked for or were close to Hitler and worked for or were close to Stalin and who suffered in the regimes and who were perpetrators in the regimes, what I began to see were a number of really fascinating similarities, but also a number of really, really interesting differences. And I thought that my perspective, coming at it as someone who'd made all these films on this and met all these crucially met these people, would be a different perspective to that of an academic historian who hadn't had that opportunity. And so it came from that, really. It wasn't that I suddenly thought, oh, this would be a good idea for a book, just out of almost as a sort of intellectual exercise. It came out of the experience of meeting people who'd personally gone through it and experienced it themselves, and then with wanting to then talk about that, but place it in, for want of a better word, a scholarly context, a context of trying to use the best of the academic work. And there's some brilliant academic work that's gone on in this area over the last 30 years. So it was trying to get that combination between the two and point out how they both interacted with each other, because that was another crucial aspect. Obviously, they're both aware of each other and interacting with each other during the war period, which is why I focused it on that. And then finally, it was because I wanted to examine this overarching theme that I perceived, which was that both of them actually, despite their number of similarities, many differences, both of them had one overarching similarity, which was this belief that they could create a utopia on Earth. And that was this extraordinary concept that linked them actually fundamentally together.
And was that utopianism, was that common to other dictators, or is that what sets these two apart from, say, Mao, Ho Chi Minh, Mussolini?
I'm not even convinced it's necessarily either or. I mean, it's clearly some kind of scale, if you like. But if you look at, for example, Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein is a thug. He's a brutal, kind of mafia-like dictator. If you look at someone like Pol Pot, then actually they also have this utopian vision that they're seeking to build here. And I think that there is a difference between a dictator who is simply kind of in it for the personal aggrandizement, is in it to benefit his family, is in it almost as a kind of quasi-mafia boss, and a tyrant who has come to power actually convinced they have uncovered the secret of existence, and it's their mission to try and create the world that's in their imagination almost here on Earth. And once you've got a tyrant who's doing that, it seems to me you have the potential for levels of human disaster that are almost unfathomable.
And I wonder if we could go into a little bit about what those visions were. What was Hitler's utopian vision, and how did that contrast with Stalin's?
The central belief of Adolf Hitler was that the world is understood through racism, that the world is a brutal, desperate place ruled by laws of nature, primal laws of nature, and the most primal of all of them is that victory goes to the strongest. So, and the strongest you understand by in racial terms, starting off of originally from a belief in it's black people, sort of Asian people, white people, and so on, and that the white person is the most superior, and within that there are ways of understanding different groups. So you've got a Slavic group, you've got obviously a Jewish group, and you've got a white Aryan group, the Aryans who he thought were the most superior. And that's why, in this context, he saw the Jews as so uniquely dangerous, not because of any religious beliefs at all. He believed that that there was such a thing as Jewish blood that made them racially uniquely dangerous. Which is why they sought to persecute Jews on the basis of race, not religion. But where it went wrong is, of course, they for them, in terms of their, even in their own little, this is all, it bears repeating, this is all nonsensical, and it's despicable, it's outrageous, this belief. But nonetheless, it was held, it was honestly held by these people. I mean, honestly, in the sense that they genuinely believed it. But what happens with the Jews is they can't devise a test, of course, for Jewish blood and working out who's a Jew and who isn't. So they end up with a test which is religious, which is the number of grandparents you had that were practicing the Jewish faith. But if you look back at, say, the persecution of the Jews in previous history, very often there's a way of a Jew escaping terrible, horrible persecution by converting to become a Christian. Absolutely inconceivable within the Nazi state to do that, because it's not about what they're believing at all. And that's one of the things stemming from this racial vision, stemming from this vision of the world being a cruel, violent place where only the stronger deserve to live. It's that that eliminates any sense of individual compassion, any sense of individual care. It's immaterial, absolutely immaterial, that you could have a Jewish person who is keen to serve the state. Immaterial, doesn't matter. It's the blood. And that was what he genuinely, ludicrously, but he genuinely believed.
And so then what would you see as Stalin's vision?
Stalin, by contrast, he would have absolutely thought this was the nonsensical rubbish to which it is. He comes at it from a Marxist perspective. He comes at it from the belief that what he is trying to do is to eliminate all of the evils of society that he has seen happen, which are fundamentally that you have a group of people who are controlling the levers of power, controlling the means of production, owning vast estates, and have done nothing to deserve it. They've simply been born in the right place, and now they're in a position to essentially persecute the people who are working for them and deny them all sorts of rights. And that the way through that is following the dictates of Marx. The way through that is to create this perfect society, initially a socialist society, moving on to a communist society, but a perfect society in which people are living as far as possible equal lives. People are living as far as possible lives where they understand that what's important is that they contribute to the state, and that the state will then organize through various systems, will organize equality of opportunity, equality of education, elimination of all private ownership, because by definition that's unfair and unjust, and create a society that gets rid of all those previous abuses. And that initially that will be socialism as a way through to ultimately communism, and the ultimate end game of communism, as seen by Marx. I say this is a simplification, because there's a huge element of complexity within Marx that scholars still argue about, rather like I always think Christians would, particularly in previous times, would argue about very detailed elements of the of Christian belief, and there would be various heretics on one side or the other within the broad Christian belief structures. But broadly, they were Stalin is looking, at least he claims to be looking, to create a world in which the state will wither away. And then what will happen is everyone will live together in this extraordinary dreamlike utopia where we don't really need much government of any kind, and everybody's equal, everybody's happy, and it's this wonderful kind of paradise on earth.
Now, I realise the consequences were horrendous in both cases, but certainly from the way you're describing it, is it fair to say that Stalin's vision was a little more, I don't know if you'd say idealistic, more positive, less imbued with hatred than that of Hitler's?
That's a really fascinating question, because that was initially, I remember 30 years ago when I kind of started on all this work, I remember this one of the scholars I was talking to who had a kind of relatively common view for then, which was, well, Hitler, and he summarized it as if, you know, he said, if I was talking to a child, he said, I would say that Hitler was somebody who had who did very, very bad things and had a very bad goal in sight. And Stalin was a person who did very, very bad things, but had a rather noble goal in sight. I don't agree with that at all. Where I've come to is to believe that both of them are bad people with bad goals. And the reason that Stalin's goal is bad is because I do not, for two reasons. First, I don't necessarily believe that he believed that this was ever a possibility, that this kind of extraordinary, wonderful, utopian paradise state is going to be wonderful, and it's going to be even conceivable. I mean, how is that ever actually going to happen? And I came across a speech that he made just before the war, which I think is of huge significance, and I haven't seen much as much emphasis on that speech as I think it should have, in which he himself admits that this is a goal that will be incredibly hard to achieve. And he says, essentially in this speech, and I paraphrase, he says, well, we all know we're aiming for the goal of this extraordinary utopian state where we don't really need government and so on. But what we've got to understand is that that's only possible if the whole world goes communist. Because how can we do that and get rid of our, as he called them, security organs, by which he means the secret police and all the apparatus around that, as well as the armies and so on. How can we divest ourselves of that if other people have it? Because then they're just that we're putting ourselves massively at risk. So we can't do that. So these institutions, these oppressive institutions, it doesn't use the word oppressive, but that's what they are. These will have to stay. So he's admitting that actually, in order to get to this ultimate goal, the whole world will have to go communist. Well, does anyone seriously think how on earth is that going to be achieved or conceived? So it's kind of like an impossible goal. That's my first point. My second point is, even if the impossible goal was achieved, if you can argue that it's conceivable, supposing I live in this wonderful new utopian state where there's no real government, everyone's really happy, but I actually passionately believe that we ought to have a form of liberal democracy, and we ought to have some form of local government or whatever. I believe things that aren't compatible with the idea of the extraordinary utopian state. As soon as I believe that, I have to be repressed because I'm a danger to the broader state. So actually, even within this utopian world, there has to be oppression. There has to be the putting down, or the either through prison or any form, but the putting down of people who don't subscribe to that vision. So therefore, it's going to be oppressive, which is why I end the introduction to the book by saying oppression's not a part of the system, in either system, Nazism or Stalinism. Oppression is the system.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, this book is drawn a lot from your interviews with people who met both of the two dictators. And just, I wonder, on a personality level, how did the two differ as humans, as people to encounter?
I think they were incredibly different. And that's one of the things that interests me about this, is to what it would be like to, you know, to having met people who walked into a room and had meetings with Hitler and walked into a room and had meetings with Stalin. And it's very, very different. It's different at a number of levels. The first thing to say is that Hitler was enormously fond of the sound of his own voice. So he would talk. It would be a problem in a meeting with Hitler if you said certain trigger words. You know, if you said, well, of course, you know, there's a problem with this or that. And he went, yes. And then he would be off. You know, he'd go. And you had a real problem because he would just, as they in modern day parlance, go off on one. But I don't believe that anybody who was a member of the Nazi state and took a meeting with Hitler was ever, or I'm not aware of it, there may have been, but I'm not aware of it, ever took that meeting as a normal functionary within the state and was frightened. Because Hitler actually had very, very set areas that he was focused and targeted on. And you really, as a general rule, you had to be plotting against him in order for there to be a real problem. The famous Night of the Long Knives, where Ernst Röhm, his chief of staff, was caught and killed. He was allegedly plotting. It's never been absolutely established the extent to which Röhm was plotting that the stormtroopers take over the move through and have functions of the army and so on. That's this argument around that. But nonetheless, Hitler was pushed into a position, or at least felt he was in a position where he had to take action. There were a number of people killed in that. A former chancellor's wife, who was totally had no role in any of this, and she was killed as these assassins came in, and so there were those numbers of people who suffered it utterly unjustly. But it's not the same as the kind of thing that's going on with Stalin. So, as a broad general rule, you were safer if you're a normal functionary in the state in a meeting with Hitler than you are with Stalin. Stalin, you were always at risk. Even if you are a loyal functionary of the state, if he feels that you are, if he's got any suspicions about you, you are in possibly fatal trouble. And the other thing about Stalin in that context is that he doesn't go off on one. He doesn't talk. On the contrary, he watches. He's an extremely aggressive listener, and he's watching all the time. And that must have been a pretty terrifying experience for some of these people to be in those meetings. The problem with Stalin was that you had to be very careful. You had to be extremely careful. If he felt you were lying, if he felt you were in any way not delivering, if he felt you were in any way responsible for, in your past, you'd met people who he had turned against and so on. It was a very, very, very different scenario. So at a personal level, taking a meeting with Hitler versus taking a meeting with the Stalin, they would be very, very different experiences for you. What's intriguing is that if for very many Western politicians who come across, and there's not that many actually, who are necessarily coming across both of them, but I think that for those who are, if you take Anthony Eden, for instance, he talks about meeting with Stalin, and he talks about Stalin in terms of this is an extremely impressive individual who is able to debate, who's able to be focused in a meeting on narrow things, who's able to take the conversation one way or the other. I mean, the number of people like Field Marshal Allenbrook, like Alexander Cadogan of the Foreign Office, who actually seem almost impressed by Stalin because I think they recognize in him this kind of very careful bureaucrat who, or at least not a bureaucrat, but someone who is steeped in bureaucracy, who's come through that that system, understands committee meetings. Hitler just hated committee meetings. Stalin comes through a system where he's actually orchestrating a whole administrative structure that he understands. And so he's almost more accessible to some of these Western statesmen and bureaucratic functionaries than Hitler is.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So there is a kind of brotherhood between them that you see, which is that they both understand. They both believe in torture. They both believe in terror. They both believe that murder is an acceptable way forward. They both believe in a whole host of things that actually the Western democracies that Stalin has to subsequently deal with aren't subscribing to.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
So did people's impression of these leaders depend partly on their ideological conviction? So would a committed communist or a committed Nazi be more impressed in meeting their leaders than an outsider?
Absolutely. That's true of both. But I think it's primarily true of Hitler. I think what you see with Hitler is that if you are, and I think it relates to the different types of leadership. So Hitler is, as Max Weber would have described him in his classic work of the early 20th century, Hitler is the absolutely archetypal charismatic leader. Now that we use charisma today as the term of approbation, we think, oh, that's an admirable quality to have. Actually, in terms of concepts of political leadership, charisma is a neutral term. It's value neutral. You can be a charismatic leader and do terribly appalling things. But Hitler is a charismatic leader in that his authority comes from himself and through him, through his followers. It doesn't come from the systems of the state, as Stalin's authority certainly initially does. And so with charismatic leaders, I think it depends very, very much the charisma on the beliefs of the people who are encountering them or seeing them or viewing them or reading about them. So charisma isn't a quality, I don't believe, that exists of itself. You're not charismatic walking around alone on a desert island. Charisma is a description of a quality that exists between two people or between one person and an audience. And it comes, and it's created in that gap. So it comes from the mutuality of beliefs from the people who believe this is an amazingly impressive person and that person. So you find that the experience of meeting Hitler very much depended on what you yourself brought in to it, in a way that I don't believe that the experience of meeting Stalin depended very much necessarily on what you're bringing into it. At least, of course, it does in some regard, but not as much as with Hitler.
Now, your book focuses on the events of World War II primarily. How well do you think these two leadership styles were suited to that conflict?
That's, again, my goodness, that's a huge question. Crikey, I could do, you know, that's the question of someone's PhD, you know. I think what's fascinating about it in terms of their leadership style is that of the two regimes, Nazism is one of the most dynamic systems, I think, that there's been in recent times. It's extraordinarily, I mean, it's relatively short-lived. It's only that the Reich only lasts 12 years. And yet it's got this extraordinary dynamism within it in terms of what is actually going on. If you think about it, Hitler plays the central part in three of the most consequential decisions ever taken in history. That is to say, the decision to invade Poland that kickstarts and causes the and starts the Second World War, the decision to invade the Soviet Union in June 1941, which is the biggest and bloodiest and most appalling war in modern times, certainly, that anyone's ever seen. And thirdly, Hitler presides over the Holocaust, which is arguably, and I subscribe to that belief, arguably the most appalling singular crime in history. So one individual is at the center of all those three decisions. One individual. It's quite extraordinary. Very hard to point to another individual who has caused such catastrophe in the whole of human history. You know, that's another debate in which one is turns into a rather nugatory debate, I've discovered, because you end up sort of trying to calculate, well, how do we determine horror and so on, and Genghis Khan, no doubt, killed many people as he went in, you know, so on. But nonetheless, certainly in modern terms, very hard to point to an individual who has caused such catastrophe in the world as Adolf Hitler. And yet, he's not holding a great deal. You know, he's not sort of operating a normal, as we would call it, state. I mean, during the 30s, a number of people comment on how he doesn't seem to be doing much dictating, as it were. And as my great mentor, Sir Ian Kershaw, you know, once said to me, I mean, you've got a dictator who doesn't seem to be spending a great deal of time during this period dictating. So what's going on? And the answer is because, and the way that the reason that it can have this dynamism is because what he's doing is very, very clear. He has enormous clarity of vision, and he has a number of people who are then competing against each other to come up with ways of fulfilling that vision. So, for example, you see that he is the one who is driving in autumn of 1939 and spring of 1940 the decision to invade Western Europe. And a number of his generals think this is an absolutely ridiculous idea, that they're bound to fail. And yet he pushes and pushes and pushes them. And in the end, he starts picking a plan that arguably comes from this guy, an officer called Manstein, the plan which eventually pushes through and defeats France and the other countries of Western Europe that are invaded. So, and this is an... There isn't as much focus, I don't believe, on the decision-making process that leads to the conquest of Western Europe, land-based Western Europe, not obviously Britain. The process through which that happens is quite extraordinary. I mean, that is one of the single greatest military triumphs, again, arguably of all time, overshadowed completely by the way it all goes wrong for the Nazis in the Soviet Union. But that and the way that that works is a function of how his leadership works and how he is able through his charismatic leadership to operate. So you have that on the one hand, and then you have on the other hand Stalin, who is reading documents, reading way more documents than Hitler's ever reading about things. Because Stalin is through in his nature so incredibly suspicious, he's always worried about information that's being secretly pushed round him. So he's reading all the intelligence documents, as many as he can, in 1940 through into the first half of 1941. He's trying to understand that himself, and he's so desperate to believe that Hitler isn't going to invade, that he starts trying to create around him this alternate universe in which, oh, it's not really going to happen. And then, once they do invade in June 1941, he has, if not a breakdown, and again, there's a lot of debate about exactly how he goes through those first few weeks, if not a breakdown, certainly he's not in a good place, as one might put it colloquially. He makes a series of terrible military decisions, culminating in the loss of the Battle of Kiev in the autumn of 1941, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Soviet soldiers are captured or killed. And he's making terrible decisions. He's making terrible decisions because, unlike Hitler, who ultimately is setting a vision and then trusting his functionaries, his generals, or his other functionaries to carry this through, Stalin is interfering at a very, very, very detailed level in what his generals are doing on the ground and saying, no, you can't retreat, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it's catastrophic. So in that initial period of the war, you have, I think, a huge difference between the two in terms of their own leadership tactics.
But then ultimately, considering the outcome of the war, was it Stalin's pragmatism or adaptability that in the end meant that his regime was able to defeat Hitler's?
I think there's a huge, again, big question. Big question. Why did the war go as it did in succinctly? I think it's, to me, I point to mid-October 1941, almost as the moment that the whole of the 20th century turned and our lives really turned. I believe that because that's the moment when Stalin decides not to leave Moscow. He decides not to leave Moscow with the Germans seemingly about to encircle Moscow, and there are already calls for Stalin to go safe further east, and a number of various ministries in Moscow have already been moved further east. And Stalin actually goes down to a station in Moscow where his armored train is waiting, and I met Stalin's personal telegraphist, who was already packed up from the Kremlin, all the equipment, and was down there waiting on the train to go. And I think one of the big central counterfactual questions of the 20th century is what happens if Stalin gets on that train? In the end, he decides not to. He decides to tough it out in Moscow, to impose a state of siege, to get Zhukov to try and organize Zhukov and a number of other generals, but primarily Zhukov, to organize the defense of Moscow. And they hold the Germans there. Now, that becomes the turning point, I think. Everything turns on that moment. And from that moment, Stalin makes in the spring of 1942 a series of catastrophic military decisions. But as you get more towards the end of 42 and the Operation Uranus and the movement against Stalingrad and so on, you begin to see that Stalin actually understands that he has to, particularly, I think, with Zhukov, he actually has to give more latitude to these people, otherwise he's going to lose the war. So Stalin is perfectly capable of losing the war through his own character and personality if he does not ameliorate it. And the first sign of that change, I think, is his decision not to leave Moscow, because in many ways the pragmatic bureaucratic decision would have been to leave. And he doesn't go because he actually, I think, understands that the message that sends of a strong leader essentially fleeing would be catastrophic.
Would you say that both leaders were a hindrance ultimately to their war efforts?
Well, you can't really say that of Stalin, because they did win.
Right, yes.
And so therefore you can't say he was... I mean, what people, I think, have to understand is that the dynamism within the Third Reich, but also the absolute essential belief that the country needs to expand. The country cannot survive with the amount of land essentially it's got. It has to gain extra territory, and that territory can only be gained at the expense of others. Therefore, there has to be a major, major war. So at a purely practical level, they're going to get into a major war in the East. That's going to happen. It also fits with Hitler's mindset, as I was talking about earlier, at an almost quasi-philosophical level, which is he believes that what the world is about is struggle. And he believes that the way you develop, I think, as a personality is through fight. You prove yourself by your fight and your strength. So it's always going to go this way. It's arguable, deeply arguable, whether they could ever have succeeded in the war in the East. Even if Stalin leaves Moscow and there's some kind of peace deal put together like Brest-Litovsk, in 1918, whereby the Germans have access to bits of Ukraine and the Baltic states and so on. One of the fundamental reasons they're going into the Soviet Union is in search of oil, and the oil is enormous distances away in Baku and the whole area around the Caspian Sea. So hard to see how a peace deal is going to allow that, and that's the oil they're after. So this is one of the terrible problems with counterfactual history. You get so many what ifs, you spirals away. But so it's hard to see a scenario in which that war is going to be ended in a way that Hitler's satisfied without the total destruction, essentially, of the Soviet Union, because he's looking for the oil. So that's one kind of reason why it's, not going to say it's always doomed, but there's always going to be deep, deep problematical situation there. With Stalin's very, very different, because actually he already has all the land he needs. I mean, it's look at the size of the Soviet Union. I mean, his issue is the governance within the Soviet Union and the way in which you retain control of this vast state. Communism, of course, talks about global revolution, and Trotsky, for instance, was always talking about global revolution. But Stalin's attitude to that is distinctly ambivalent. Through a number of things, and I think it's ambivalent because he understands that his challenge is to transform this giant state, which has all the land, you know, enormous quantities of land, in the way that Hitler doesn't. So therefore, he doesn't have to plan on this vast military scheme of conquest.
Now, one thing that both dictators shared was the capacity to murder millions of people. But are there important differences in how and why they exercise this brutality?
Yes. Can I just leave it at that? No. Yes, absolutely. Of course there are. The extraordinary thing that happens is, of course, the Holocaust. And it's important to understand that the Holocaust comes out not just of a lengthy prehistory of deep anti-Semitism, of racial-based anti-Semitism, of a belief that the Jews are incredibly dangerous. All that belief structure, which existed certainly in the Third Reich before the war, but the actual creation of the death camps, the systematic mass extermination of the Jews, comes from the invasion of the Soviet Union. After that, it was only in the context after that that all of these particular horrors that we associate with the Holocaust happen. Now, prior to that, it can be argued, and I make some of these points in the book, it can be argued that the sort of ways in which Hitler is approaching that are in many respects similar to the ways in which Stalin is persecuting large numbers of people. For example, I see Poland really as this kind of awful, terrible experiment between both of them in terms of ethnic cleansing and suffering and murder and so on. Poland really is ripped apart, literally ripped apart, because in 1939 it split between the Nazis and the Soviets. Again, this is something that I don't think is fully understood in many people today. They don't understand that actually the Red Army invades in September shortly after the Germans have invaded, and they split Poland between them. And both of them approach this ethnic cleansing in not dissimilar ways. So, for example, one crucial element of it is deportation. Both believe that one way to reorder a society is to deport people who you think are unsuitable in various ways. So the Nazis are involved in deporting Poles from areas they want to Germanize into other areas of Poland that they want to colloquially, somebody called the dustbin of the Reich, this area called the general government around Krakow. Stalin, because he has vast spaces and there is a history of deportation, actually deports large numbers, enormous numbers of Poles from eastern Poland right the way into the wilds of the Soviet Union, where many die. So both of them are approaching this in very much the same way. Both understand, for example, the power of hunger. They both understand that if you withhold food, you kill and manipulate people. So you see that with the treatment of people in the gulags. You see that with the suffering of people in these forced communities that many go to as I say, the wilds of the Soviet Union. You see that throughout Nazi-occupied states, where only those thought worthwhile people are allowed to eat. So you see it in a whole number of ways. The interesting, the fascinating thing, the horrible, terrible thing is how the Holocaust, which is different in kind, comes through this, comes through these early horrors and develops into what it finally becomes.
Now, I know that the two leaders never met, but do we know how did Hitler and Stalin view each other?
I think it's pretty clear that Stalin has great respect for Hitler. And I think Stalin, in many, many ways, is frightened of Hitler. Hitler has a more of an ambivalence. Hitler remarks to Goebbels, his propaganda minister, who kept a diary, as we know, Hitler remarks before the war that Stalin must be sick in the brain to kill so many people during the Great Terror of the late 30s, when he starts murdering large numbers of people as enemies of the people. And Hitler thinks that's, you know, quote, sick in the brain. But then during the war, you see how Hitler begins to have this respect for Stalin, and he talks about how wise Stalin was to purge off certain officers in the Red Army to ensure that it was a politically loyal machine, because Hitler begins to think that the army is not as loyal to him as it should be, and the officer corps is not as loyal to him as it should be. And so he begins to envy Stalin for that. So I think that overall, you could say they both have a kind of grudging respect for each other and understanding of each other. And you see that if you compare the deal, the meeting that Stalin has with Ribbentrop in the summer of 1939, out of which comes the Nazi-Soviet Pact, even though ideologically you can see that these two regimes are at opposite ends, or if not at opposite ends, they're very different ideologically. Even though there's that, they understand the nature of oppression and the nature of terror, and they can rapidly come to agreements. When Anthony Eden visits Stalin, not that much later, at the end of 1941, when Anthony Eden visits Stalin, there is an extraordinary moment in that meeting when Stalin essentially says, well, let's have a secret protocol to this deal. You can organize, you know, and Eden is sort of rather appalled, I think, by this, that this is sort of, this is not how we conduct ourselves. So that actually the problem that Stalin then has dealing with these Western democracies is that he can't deal with them in the same way that he was able to deal with the Nazis. So there is a kind of brotherhood between them that you see, which is that they both understand. They both believe in torture, they both believe in terror, they both believe that murder is an acceptable way forward, they both believe in a whole host of things that actually the Western democracies that Stalin has to subsequently deal with aren't subscribing to.
Now, one question that's often asked, though perhaps not always by serious historians, is which of these two dictators was the worst? I mean, do you think there's any value in trying to make a comparison like that?
Again, it's a really hard question to answer because at one level, it's an easy question to answer because you immediately have to say, what do you mean by worst? And therein is the rub, because I don't think anyone can define what they mean by worst. What they mean, I think colloquially, what they mean by worst is how many non-combatant civilians can you say that each is responsible for the death of? But what you can't do is calculate individual suffering, the extent of individual suffering. You can't calculate the individual levels of terror. You can't. I mean, the worst actually sounds like a straightforward question, but actually it's a deeply freighted question within which the meaning of the word worst is not clear, and it's just simply not an accessible word. It's not, each person has got a different view of worst, which is why in the book I don't address, let's say, who's worst. What I address at the end is an attempt to say, who can we say was responsible for the death of most non-combatant civilians? And that is a question we can attempt to answer. It's one we have to attempt to answer with great care and sensitivity, because an individual death, some of these stories and people I've met whose lives were destroyed and families killed and suffered in the most appalling ways. I've met so many people on both sides who have the most terrible, terrible, heart-wrenching experiences, that to then lump them all together as a number, somehow it's, you know, it's problematic. You've got to be very careful with that, because in the book, what I think is that there is sufficient material from individuals who suffered to hopefully alleviate that. But if we're talking in terms of general numbers, then what the new research has begun to show is that you can certainly say that Hitler is responsible for the death of more people. It's a very, very complex subject to address for a whole variety of reasons that I go into in the book. But you, as a broad brush, you could say that Hitler is responsible for the death of at least 20 million of these people, and Stalin perhaps up to or around 13 million. Those are very, very, they're very, very broad brush numbers, but it gives you a sense of the scale. And you have to say within that, you can't then say, I wouldn't extrapolate from that, that Hitler is necessarily, you say, so he's sort of proportionately worse, whatever. Because the suffering that Stalin is creating is so unspeakable. I mean, it's absolutely appalling that you can't negate it. You don't then go, I don't feel so bad about that as I do about Hitler or whatever. It's actually a function. Those numbers are in part a function of what I was mentioning earlier, which is the sense in which Hitler felt the absolute necessity to create this vast empire, and within that vast empire to remove people who he thought weren't of use to the Nazi state. So it's a function in part of the expansion allied to the exterminatory nature of how he's approaching it.
That was Lawrence Rees. Hitler and Stalin, The Tyrant and the Second World War, is out now, published by Viking. And Lawrence also wrote a piece about the two dictators in the December issue of BBC History magazine. That's no longer on sale in the UK, but is available as a back issue and may still be on sale in some other countries. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow with another lecture from our History Weekend events.